This is July 7th, and I'm interviewing Kenneth Richard Stafford, and I'm Brenda Gilbo, the volunteer.
I'm Ken Stafford, and I'm giving you the history of my family from when they started back in, as far as I can go, which is about the 1800s. And my great-granddad, John Stafford, and his wife, Elizabeth, my great-grandparents moved from the U.S. to Barrie, Ontario, somewhere in the early 1800s. My granddad, Frank, was born to John and Elizabeth Stafford in 1860 in Barrie, Ontario. Frank grew up in Barrie. Later, he met Margaret McQueen, who had immigrated to Canada from Scotland with her parents. Frank and Margaret were married in 1887 and farmed in Prairie Sound, Ontario, until 1894. During this time, they had four children, and at the end, in 1894, they decided to move out west with the four kids. They joined the Prairie Sound Colony, which is a group of people from Ontario, and together they all headed west. They ended up at Brudaheim, where Frank homesteaded. This was still part of the Northwest Territories. Two more children were born, Grace in 1897, and my dad was finally born in 1899. In 1903, he sold the homestead and moved to a farm near Lamont. Then he built a livery stable in Lamont and contracted the mail run from Lamont to Saddle Lake. In 1911, Frank obtained two South African scrips, which were the same as homestead rights. So Frank filed on the east half of 56723, north of Athabasca, just northeast of where Baptist Creek meets the Athabasca River. Frank's family came to Athabasca on the first working train that came to town. That was when the railroad opened, first came into service. Frank and Margaret built their house on the boundaries between the northeast and the southeast of 56723. As in those days, the homestead required you to live at least 6 months a year on your own property. So they lived 6 months on one side of the house and 6 months on the other side of the house. They then bought a fraction of land between their homestead and the Athabasca River, which is northwest of 46723-4. A fraction of land between the homestead and the river. At that time, the steamboats were still traveling the river in the summer, and in the winter the freighters used the river to haul freight into the north part of Alberta. And the road from Athabasca to the west country, to Baptist Lake, Smith, and that area, crossed the creek right by the river, which they had a forge. They had no bridges, but they crossed the creek there. So Frank then built a stopping place between what's called the ford and the river. We put up a barn and lodging area for the freighters and feed the horses, and people could stay, probably slept in the loft of the barn. But then the stopping place was closed when the highway was built west of Athabasca, and I'm not quite sure in what date that was, but that's when they closed the stopping place. Franken was a farmer, and he started raising cattle and sheep mainly, and that because the land that he homesteaded was mainly gravel and was not good for grain farming. And in 1914, Grossmont Municipality 668 was formed. Frank Stafford was the first reeve and remained a councillor for many years on that municipal board. Frank was also the founder member of the Athabasca Agricultural Society Limited in 1914 and was on the board of directors until it disbanded again in 1920. Margaret Stafford, his wife, died in 1920, And Frank had carried on farming with the aid of his family until 1927. Then he rented out the farm. He sold it to Howard Stafford, my dad, in 1936. Frank died in 1941 at the age of 81. Howard Stafford, youngest boy of Frank and Margaret Stafford, came to Athabasca in 1912 when they homesteaded, so had very little education as the nearest school was 10 miles from where they were homesteading, so he did not go to school again, had to self-learn on his own. In 1917, Howard got his first homestead on the southwest of 1767 23-4, which is approximately 2 miles north of his dad's homestead. Then Howard went to work in Wetaspin to work for his brother-in-law, who was a farming down there. He stayed there for a year and a half or so, and in 1925, he returned home, rented another one of his brother-in-law's land on the northwest of 867 23-4, which he bought later, and there was a house on it, so that's where he moved in and lived. In 1931, Howard Stafford met Kathleen Mann, who was born in Lamont, Alberta, in 1910, and moved to Athabasca with her parents in 1925. Kathleen finished her high school in Athabasca, then went to Camrose Normal School and became a teacher. She taught her first class. Her school was at La Havre. Next year, she went north up to La Glace. Then third year, she taught at Parker School, which is east of Athabasca. While she was teaching there, she married my dad, Howard Stafford. And Kathleen quit teaching and started a family and helped with the farming. In 1931, Gordon Stafford was born. In 1936, Doreen Stafford was born. In 1938, I was born. In 1936, Howard bought out his dad, who was a mixed farmer raising cattle, hogs, and grain. In 1943, we had a severe storm come through and wiped out our crop 100%. So my mother went back teaching school and taking us kids with her. She went to Larbert School, which was approximately 5 miles away. We stayed at the teacher's beside the school. My brother Gordon and Doreen had been taking correspondence up to this time. My mother was a tough teacher, in my opinion, as she failed me in grade one the year I started. I guess I slept too much in school. In 1944, she came back to help with the farm as his kids went to Baptist Lake School, which was 4 miles the other way. We traveled there we had an old truck by this time. My dad would take us to school. Sometimes we had to go by horses and sometimes we had to walk. The following year, we were bused to Athabasca as the Baptist Lake School closed down. The first school bus was a truck with a grain box. No top, benches along the wooden benches along the sides of the box. Later in the fall, they did put a roof on top of the box, and we still had, and hauled us to school. We still had to go 3 miles to catch the bus on the highway. In 1949, the folks built a new house on the southeast of 56723. That was Ridden Homestead, and it was only 2 miles to go to catch a bus. So we had to walk all the time, got no more rides. In the same year, 1949, a gravel pit was opened on the northeast of 56723, one of the original homesteads. Gravel was taken out and used by the county and the government for paving and graveling high roads. In 1953, my brother Gordon graduated from Athabasca, went to Vermilion Agricultural College, and graduated in 1955. shortly after returning while working for a local farmer, he died in a drowning accident in Island Lake. Doreen graduated from Athabasca and went in for teaching. She taught in Athabasca and Bora. She married Reverend John Conlon, who later became Anglican Bishop of Brandon, Manitoba. He passed away in 1988, and Doreen still lives in Brandon. In 1957, I graduated from Athabasca Edmund Parr Compton High School. That fall, I attended Vermilion School of Agriculture, spent 2 years and graduated in 1959. Then I returned to the farm. My family, in the meantime, through the 50s, had built up a small dairy herd and we milked cows. Then in 1959, we built a milking parlor, which was easier for my dad while I was at college and doing things, as the milking was done by machine. In 1959, I met Thelma Marks of Rochester. She was a nursing aide at the Athabasca Hospital. We then got married in July of 8th of 1961. And we did take a honeymoon, as I had a Volkswagen Beetle, traveling to BC, down through Washington, Montana, then back up through southern Alberta. Put on 2,200 miles. My fuel bill was costing me $22, which also included an oil change. Cost of traveling was less than a cent a mile, and oil was 35 cents a quart. After returning home, we lived in Athabasca. Thelma kept on working at the hospital, and I drove out to the farm with my dad. Thelma's dad, Fred Marks, gave us two heifers when we got married, as a gift, wedding gift, I guess. We kept them for a while, but they did not fit into our dairy herd at the farm, so we ended up selling them. I did like cattle, so built a corral and bought 7 head of steer calves, put them on grass for the summer and then fattened them for the winter, selling them in the following spring and got 22 cents a pound, which I thought was doing pretty good. In the meantime, the dairy herd was sold out and the facilities were turned into a feedlot. The lot grew slowly. First year I had the 7 head, next year I had 17 head. The following year I had 37 head. Next year I had 75 head. By 1979, we were up to about 1,500 head. By this time, the yard was getting too small and it was too sheltered and would not dry. Then in 1966, our first child arrived, Christopher James, born March the 5th, 1966, and Darcy Lee, born July the 28th, 1968. Both kids went to Athabasca. Chris graduated in 84 and Darcy in 86, and both boys stayed on the farm. Then in 1968, Thelma and I purchased a house in Edmonton and had it moved out to the farm on Athabasca and put it on the southeast of 567 beside my folks. The house was a little bit too big for the road coming in, so when they got to a wooden bridge by the Hutterites, they could not get across. So they end up cutting the sides off the bridge and taking the house across, and then nailed the boards back up on the side of the bridge. I'm sure you wouldn't get away with it today. We purchased them. My dad's farm, consisting of 4 quarters, in 1969. My folks stayed on the land and retired on the farm. My dad died in 1981 and my mother in 1986. In 1977, also purchased a share in the Athabasca feed and seed mill. I was buying a lot of my feed for the feedlot through the feed mill, and so came to the conclusion that maybe I should buy a share in the meat feed mill. Later, the feed mill got into financial trouble. As a result, I bought the operation out, and my partners and I ran the mill until 1980. When I sold it later, that year, it burnt down. So then we hauled off feed from Westlock, Camp in Feeds, which had just started up a year before, making a trip a day, 5 days a week, using a truck and trailer, hauling approximately 20 tons of that load. In 1967, I bought the farm of Philip Lubaschek, which was 2/4 just west of my land. And in 1968, I purchased the farm of Malvin Woodcox, which was just north of that. All land was adjoining. There was 2 more quarters. In 1972, I hired a group of men working in the bush cutting wood saw logs for a mill to cut me fence rails out of swamp spruce as I was building my corrals out of rails. When I went to pick up the rails, they were big enough for fence posts. So now what am I going to do? After thinking about it for a couple of days, I decided maybe I should build a post builder and make fence posts. I knew the fellow by the name of Joe Bevere, who was very handy at building things. So I approached him, and he agreed to it. It took him about 2 years. I helped him quite a bit, and with the two of us, and a lot of planning, we got it built. And in 1975, it was complete and named the Roller Bark, which you may have seen the pictures of. We started peeling posts in the winter of 1975 and didn't peel too many that year. And the following year, we got in full production and peeled approximately 30,000 posts during the winter. Also poles up to 30 feet long, used for power poles, pole barns, and hay sheds, etc. I peeled posts up to about 1982, then it was sold as I was too busy with the feedlot. In 1974, I purchased the Bezik farm from Martin Davy Bezik, 5/4. This land was also adjoining most of our land. Actually, it was right next door. In 1979, we made a big decision and decided to build a large feedlot away from where we lived. As I mentioned before, it was getting too small the yard and too well sheltered, would never dry out. The northwest of 5, half a mile north of us, had very excellent slope, sloping to the east side of the quarter, which made it ideal for a feedlot. With the help of Gary Berger, the DA, District Agriculture, drew up plans and applied for permits, as we needed a permit for pumping water out of the Athabasca River, which we use for the feedlot. And we got a permit for that, and we applied for a permit to build the lot and got a permit for 6,500 head, because we had to pump approximately 2 million gallons of water a year out of the Athabasca River. Work on the new feedlot started in 1979 as we dug a dugout approximately 200 by 400 feet and 14 feet deep, which was built on a ridge above the feedlot. Now, several people laughed at me for doing this, and how am I going to fill this dugout? Never told them I was going to pump the water into it. But anyway, the dugout was only dug down about 7 feet in the ground and raised up about 7 feet to make a very high basin for we could gravity feed all the cattle pens without any use of any pumps and keep the water from running out of the feedlot into the water source. In 1980, my father-in-law, Fred Martz, agreed to supervise and help build the feedlot. Work started on the 1st of April, 1980. Bobby Gray was hired to dig the water lines, which mounted over to 2,000 feet of water lines. All trenches were left wide open until the pipe was laid in the ground, 5.5 miles of pipe. Starting with 36 lines in the first trench and one line for each pen till we got to the end of the feedlot. And we left all the trenches open and did not have a single cave-in or a single accident, which you would not be allowed to do today. Most of the work was done by local employees. It took approximately 2 years to complete the first stage. First year, we still fed cattle at home on the old lot. In the second year, we moved the cattle to the new lot, feeding up to 3,000 head. Our farming operation changed quite a bit as we went from haying in the summer to making silage. The reason for this was we could not put up enough hay to feed that amount of cattle, and the weather was always against us, whereas silage, showers and that did not hurt us. We could keep going. As we needed more feed, we bought a lot of standing crop around the country from local farmers, as far away as 10 miles, also using cereal crops, clover crops, hay crops, whichever was available, and grain, some grain crops that were not suitable for grain, we took them too, full of weeds and etc. As time went on, we rented more land, also bought some more. At the peak, we were farming about 36 quarters. We needed about 15 to 16,000 tons of silage a day, and most of that was growing on our own land. All our grain was purchased from local farmers, mainly local farmers, but some came out as far away as the Peace River country. We needed a large supply of grain. To get ample supply, we started putting up what they call high moisture grain. We would buy grain that was high in moisture from the farmers in the fall, before it was dry, and roll it and put in large bags to store, where it would keep without spoiling for a long time. One fall, we purchased up to 200,000 bushels and bagged it all. We rolled it too before we bagged it, so we were rolling 24 hours a day for weeks on end. In 1982, by the time the feedlot was known as Stafford Feeders Limited, we purchased a truck and liner that year and hauled cattle for several years. And the truck was driven by Chris Stafford. He drove for 5 years, then came back to the feedlot and we hired a driver. Upon Chris's return, we added to the feedlot, putting on another row of pens, bringing the capacity up to 6,000 head. We custom fed a lot of cattle, at times anywhere from 40 to 60%. We had customers that would feed as many as 50 head, customers that would feed thousands of head. We had customers from all across Canada and the United States. We fed cattle and calves from 300 to 400 pounds, lots of times up to 700-800 pounds, move them out to other feedlots where they would fatten them. Sometimes those cattle would go out to grass here and stay in the area and then sent south to his finishing lots in the fall. We also finished some of our own cattle and carried them right through from calves right through to finishing, up to 1,700 pounds, whatever we required. 1 year we turned over 10,000 head. Most of these cattle would go through the squeeze at least three times. And that's where the wife came in. She was a nursemaid on the health department of the cattle and looked after it, as I got too busy and she was not working. And she had a crew of girls that ran all these cattle through the squeeze, so she were good at giving needles. Later that year, we started a cow herd and ran over 600 cows and calves, taking more land, so more land was rented for pasture. After Chris returned, a shop was upgraded, and we started building a lot of our own equipment. We hired a machinist, Ken Ells, who worked for us for many years, and we also always had a mechanic. Building machinery was always on my mind. In the early years, after the square balers came out, I decided I didn't like the Stukas they were using behind the square balers that would tip and let the Stukas slide off, because sometimes these Stukas would fall over. So I built a Stuker. Instead, I would just trip and lay down flat and leave the bales sitting on the ground perfect. I built a couple of these. The welding company came to me and wanted to know if they could build them. I told them, go ahead, because I had not patented it. G&G Welding took over and built, as far as I know, approximately 40 of these Stukas. Then we built the post peeler after that, which I already mentioned, built by Joe Bevere. And then in the new lot was built, I built a new hydraulic squeeze, which is still operating today after 30 years. That was the end of my building, as Chris picked up the idea and started building equipment himself. These included 3 manure spreaders, 42-foot land roller, 10-foot grain bag for bagging grain in those big bags, a Rotomix truck, feed truck, which we used to feed cattle. These trucks were worth approximately $170,000 just for the box, and we built it for about $50,000, so a big saving. Several large roller mills for rolling grain, which are very expensive to buy. I think he built about 10 of them. Straw shredders to bed for breaking down the round bales and bedding cattle. Many other things like metal benders, metal rollers, blades for pushing silage 16 foot wide, and many, many other equipment and things. Then we got back into building the feedlot, and it was not all roses in the days of the feedlot business. As we built it in 1980, as you know, the interest rates from that time went up to 24% in 1982-83. And it was almost to the situation where we almost lost the feedlot due to high interest rates. And with a little negotiation with the bank over the year, it kept the bank from shutting me down helped me out for another year. And we got back into operation. And fortunately enough, I turned the feedlot around within the 1 year and got support back from the bank. We did have to get help from a consultant, according to the bank, to help us with the feeding industry. And the consultant I got worked with me for a year on feeding cattle and the operation of the feedlot. And at the end of the year, the consultant wrote the bank a letter and told them I knew more about feeding cattle than what he did, so they didn't think he was necessary to be on the payroll. And the bank agreed. And so I got off of having a consultant and run the feedlot on my own. And that went on pretty good then until when it was a very dry year and feed was very scarce. We were making silage and got about a ton per acre. Unfortunately, the rains came late and a lot of the crops, especially the canola crops, did not mature, and so we were able to make silage out of them. Also, some of the later grain crops. And so in the end, we end up with enough silage to get us through the year. And then the following year, we got hit again by the mad cow disease, the BSE they called it, and Canada and all the countries closed the border to Canada, which caused the cattle prices to drop drastically. I was fortunate in those years because I had 2,800 head of fats ready to be sold that winter. And when the BSE hit, I only had 2 head left in the feedlot. So I escaped the big downturn. But earlier in the year, we had purchased a large number of calves for the next year, which were in the feedlot. And so they had to go to grass for the summer as the price did not recover. And the BSE and the borders were not open for quite a while. And these calves went out to grass and then came back into the feedlot and to be finished as fats and sold the following spring. The price had not recovered, so a lot of money was lost even after the cattle were fattened. In fact, I would say close to $500,000 lost revenue in the feedlot. Now this was lost by many of my customers, including myself, but we did get some relief from the government as they paid out some differences to help us out. After we got through the cattle, that bunch of cattle, things started to turn around. The prices had dropped, but they were adjusted so that there was a small profit back in feeding cattle. So then we were buying smaller cattle and back in the business at a much lower price at the time. And this went on okay for another 4 or 5 years and got back on our track. Then we hit the E. coli outbreak at Lakeside, a packing plant owned by Nielsen Brothers, in which time the borders were closed again. I had at that time several hundred fats ready for shipping. In fact, we were just about ready to ship when the borders were closed. And they were also contracted to the Nielsen Brothers. But there was a clause in the contract stating that the borders was closed, the contract was void. And so he could not ship these fat cattle, and therefore we had to feed them for another 3 months. And the feed costs at that time was high, running over $3 a day per head. And we ended up feeding them for 90 days or better on top of that. And then when we did get a chance to sell the cattle, we had to sell them at 16 cents a pound less than what they were contracted for. With the extra 90 days of feeding and reduction in price, the feedlot ended up losing another $500,000. This was also some recovery from the support, or very little of it recovery from support of the government, but we did have insurance on some of it. After all the things went good for the next few years, but changes in the government regulations and taxes, the carbon tax, changes to unemployment, compensation on the farm, minimum wage, and all the costs like wages, gas prices going up, machine prices, environmental regulations, and employment, I decided I was getting to the age and could not keep on going. So I decided that I was going to get out of it, and so I approached Chris, my partner in crime, I guess as you say in those days, and told him I had enough, and he could either carry on or sell the farm, which he wished to do. Chris agreed to carry on and take over, so I told him I would work as a hired man. I think I worked harder then than I did before, but Chris tried to change the operation a little bit by doing more grain farming, buying larger equipment, and feeding more cows, and getting away from so many yearlings as labor, get out of the labor situation. By this time, the wife had retired and did not have her to run the back end. We then had a couple of bad years, didn't get all the crop off, so Chris decided we should maybe sell the operation, and so he listed on the real estate to be sold. After a year of listing, the Hutterite Colony decided maybe they should buy it. So in 2017, they purchased all the grain land, and in 2018, they took over the feedlot and the pasture. June the 1st, 2018, I was officially retired after the sale, which we sold out at the sale time at the end of the year. I was always interested in sports, and even when I was at school, I was very interested in sports. And since I retired, I'm glad I was. As I played basketball in high school and in college, also won the Northeastern Upper Championship in college in 1959, I guess it was, on the first line. Then I started curling when I was still in high school in 1956. I still curl today, twice a week. I played baseball for many years, probably in fastball for almost 40 years. In 1958, playing at the Athabasca, called Aces in those days, we only played tournament ball. We played 37 games and won 35 and made over $5,500 that year, which was pretty good wage for a bunch of farm boys. Then I started golfing in 1969, golfed for 2 years. Went to Westlock and I ended up winning the fourth flight, shooting a 2-over par. Jokingly, I told the people with me I should quit because I'll probably never do that again. And just jokingly, but not intending to do it, but did. I quit for 45 years when I got too busy and didn't go back golfing until 2015. Now I golf about 5 times a week. And after retiring, I decided to put my own simulator in my garage. So I'll be golfing probably every day, year-round now. Some of the other highlights from my years. In 1985, I sold the first Canadian cattle by satellite to Superior Livestock of Texas and did very good, as a lot of the buyers wanted to buy the first Canadian cattle I ever sold by television, and drove the price up that day quite a few cents just to be the first ones to buy cattle. In 1987, we received the Farm Family Award to Northlands, and represented it at Klondike Days in Edmonton. And in 1993, We shipped a large number of cattle, biggest shipment out of the feedlot at one time to Greeley, Colorado. 10 liner loads, 700 head plus, all which were hauled 1,350 miles to Greeley. There is a picture of all the liners lined up on the road next to the feedlot. We did a lot of cattle testing nowadays, drug testing for the companies, feeding for the testing for the feed company, additives for the feed companies, health and introduction costs of cattle all through the different organizations. I give several talks on feedlot operations, cattle health, feeding of cattle, processing of calves, marketing of cattle. I give talks to all the way across Alberta, through Vermilion, Lethbridge, Edmonton, High Prairie, Grand Prairie, Fairview, Vermilion College, and found it quite enjoyable. I even got into the university and gave a talk at the university. The only time in my life I ever got to the university to go to school. But I gave a talk on feedlots to the agriculture class a few years ago. In 2012, we received our 50 year of marriage certificate, 100 years of landowner certificate, and 50 years of farming all at one time.
Thank you very much. That was a very interesting history. And
Thank you.